Okay. 9:30. It's good to see everybody. Good to have the rains without all the winds. I don't know about right here, but where we were, it was just good rain. We're going to do all we can to get through the book of Joshua and perhaps introduce, talk about a little bit Ruth and Judges, maybe even get to 1 Samuel some, though I've got the slide set for just really the book of Joshua. But when we get to Joshua, we're in the promised land, and everything kind of goes uphill and then downhill and then uphill and then downhill as far as the spiritual conflicts of God's people. So the landmass will stay the same, and we'll talk more about that. So I'm eager to get really now, this stage, more towards the New Testament, but I've got to slow myself down just a little bit here through the month of April and try to pick out topics that I think are intriguing relative to Bible geography. All right. Brother Mike Bonner is in a gospel meeting this week. He's been pretty busy. He, I think, was in Marlin, Texas, Friday and Saturday for a speaking engagement, and then he started a gospel meeting this morning. And I forget where that gospel meeting was located. So I see the college kids coming in, and that's why you're in this class, I suppose. Not over there hanging out. All right, we ended on Mount Nebo where Moses died, and I just put that back on the screen for our own sake. Remember, this is the location at the end of Deuteronomy where we find out Moses will go up and will die, and he will be buried. We don't know much about this account. A lot of speculation on the end of Deuteronomy. Who wrote that context? Was it Moses being inspired to write about his own death? Very likely could have been. Moses knew that his demise was at hand, and it would not be something impossible or uncommon. Did Joshua write it by inspiration in retrospect? I take more of the position that Moses actually wrote this himself, and because there's no dispute on the actual content of Deuteronomy through the book of Genesis, these five books, and them being labeled the Mosaic books or the books of Moses. And so we have to remember something as well, too. Even though Moses was not allowed to go into the promised land, how old was Moses when he died? 120 years old, and what kind of a life did he live, especially the last 40 years of his life? Yeah, Randy says probably a tiresome life, you know, dealing with God's people, complaining and wandering around for 40 years. You know, Moses' life was surely a life that was fulfilled. He had suffered much frustration himself. He yet was early on raised up in the house of Pharaoh his first 40 years. And so he had quite the experience. And you have to keep in mind, from that vantage, going into the promised land was fixing to begin a completely new, aspect, a new, experience, if you will. And so, for a 120-year-old man who had had the law given to him, it doesn't hurt my feelings at all to say that by the time Mount Nebo comes around, he was probably tired. And perhaps being able to just look over into the promised land and say, I got them here, you know, I don't see any argument. I don't see any argument with Moses himself. So this screen kind of gives you a visual of the location. That's probably not the best imagery as far as what that appears, because that makes it, that shot, and I couldn't find a better one really, that shot makes it look like it's just miles and miles away. Actually, up there at Mount Nebo, you could probably see very clearly the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea, and see that land that was full of milk and honey and fertile. So we read that account in Deuteronomy last Wednesday. Any comments or questions before we get to the great experience of Joshua? Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You don't see him debating with God. Even when he sinned and he smote the rock, when he was told to talk or speak, when he cast down the stone, you know, he comes down. You're talking about a man who accepted his consequence with great humility, understanding. I mean, Moses may be one of the most understudied characters in the Bible in one sense. We talk a lot about Abraham, and rightly so. We talk a lot about David and men, but have you really stopped to think about the character study of Moses and what he accomplished? Again, he ends on a high note in my mind. He gets them right there to that promised land. He knows in his mind they're fixing to have to go in and fight. He knows there's more wars and a lot of things are going to take place. So, okay, another thing too that made me think of at the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew 17, who is there? Moses. Who else is there? The great prophet. That's right. So you have those representatives of God's Old Testament prophets and the law, the very staple elements of your Old Testament scripture. You know, so again, God had great fondness for Moses. Okay, let's go back to here. Alright, now we get to this context in Joshua chapter 3 where they are at the brink of the promised land. They're ready to go over. I wish that in my mind, this is a study of the book of Joshua. So I want to look at really Joshua chapter 1, chapter 2 just to remind you of some of the great encouragement of God to Joshua. Look at verse 2 of chapter 1. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses, from the wilderness, and here's your boundaries. Here's the complete boundary of the land of promise. And before I read this, do they, by the end of Joshua, secure all this boundary? They don't. They are given the land, but there is still fighting that will have to take place. In fact, do you remember in the book of 1 Samuel, the great enemy of God's people that will continue to plague them, and the Ark of the Covenant is taken early on? Do you remember the people that does that takes the Ark? 1 Samuel chapter 4 is the chapter. The Philistines. Philistines are difficult people. Who is it that takes part in destroying a lot of the Philistines during the book of the Judges? Samson. And by really kind of a almost a backward means, you know, a guy who's marrying women he shouldn't be marrying. He's got this long hair and so forth. But the Philistines, my point really I wanted to make is you get to 1 Samuel, you're still not in a land that is completely conquered, even though God has given it to them. Now, Joshua tells them at the end of his life in Joshua 21 and Joshua 24, Joshua 21, that God has given you this land. This land is yours. You're here. But the fight continues. The residual effects of some of these nations are still here. But do you remember, I think someone may have mentioned it just a second ago, do you remember the timeline or when we actually secure all the boundaries of this land? Under what regime or under whose leadership? Say it again. David? Yes, I kept hearing David in a small, still voice. Yes, it's not until we get to King David. Another one of God's little shepherd boys who's young and valiant, and God is apparently preparing for great things. It's under his leadership that we'll finally secure and get rid of the Philistines. Yes, sir. That's right. Oh. And we have to understand that this land was a place for preparation. this land was a place for fulfillment, for something bigger. This land was not going to be the eternal place like the Jehovah's Witness and others would like it to be. This land is a place where God will bring forth ultimate redemption, spiritual, eternal salvation, a salvation that today people still don't understand the nature of it. Even though in this timeline we see people who are constantly saying, this land is not our home. We are pilgrims, we're strangers. Abraham, the forefather, was looking for a home, a house whose builder was God, not a house made with man's hands. And so those attitudes are still reflective here in the Old Testament scriptures, though they were told to secure and take this land. Because God was going to do some great things. He was going to help, through the nation of Israel, evangelize, be a light to people, bring people back to him that had departed, going back to the days of Noah and after Noah's day. People that had wandered far away, become pagan, idolatrous. God would again, through the hand of Moses, do what to Egypt? Even though Pharaoh hardened his heart, God said to Pharaoh, Moses, he's going to harden his heart. But to these people in Egypt, I'm going to show my power 10 powerful ways and demonstrate who is the Almighty, not these gods that they have created in their own mind, the imagination, and so on and so forth. And so we finally will get through all this. But back to Joshua. In Joshua chapter 1, as Don was saying, notice here again what is being said to Joshua, the boundaries here, verse 4 and following. From the wilderness and thus Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your coast. There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Be strong and of good courage, for unto this people shalt thou divide for an inheritance the land which I swear unto their fathers to give unto them. Only be thou strong. Again, look at the conditions here for Joshua. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. The book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then, there's again your condition, then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. Have not I commanded thee? Be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. And so Joshua commanded the officers of the people. He will prepare them, verse 11, to cross over, to take and possess the land, and to spy out the land. They'll do that. They will answer him in chapter 1, verse 16. All that thou hast commanded us will we do. Chapter 2, Rahab receiveth and concealeth the two spies in Shittim, the covenant between her and them. This is that language I want you to notice here in verse 10, chapter 2. Just placing it, highlight historical information of what took place back in Egypt. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side, Jordan, Sihon, and Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. That's the point that God is wanting to make throughout all of this. Your God, the God of the Israelites, the God of Abraham, he is the only God of heaven and earth. So many people were worshiping the earth and elevating animals, flies, frogs, locusts, to some status of godhood. And the point here God is making throughout all of this historically is that there is but one God. It's the same thing he does to the king of Babylon and Daniel. It's the same concept and principle that through captivity, I'm going to allow you to take my people. But you remember Daniel, the one who could reveal the dreams? And you remember the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. And he even tells Nebuchadnezzar of his fate. And what does Nebuchadnezzar say at the end of his life before he dies? He makes this great confession that there is but one God who is over all. And all those goddesses and gods of the Babylonians were just dismantled over and over again, historically speaking. And that's the story here. That's the conflict that you see throughout the Bible. So, narrowing it back down, when we get back to this context, really, that runs through 1 Samuel. And the Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant in 1 Samuel chapter 4, and it is, by the way, in the Philistinians? Can you say that? I think that sounds right. It's in their possession until who gets it? Who has to go get that Ark of the Covenant back? And then, and actually getting the Ark of the Covenant back, they're not doing it right, and the oxen stumbles. Who's the king then? That's David. How many years is it over there in the Philistinian captivity, in their temple? How many years did Saul reign? 40 years. Do we stop and realize that Ark of the Covenant is gone for a long time? Do we stop and realize that the Ark of the Covenant is not placed in the temple that Solomon builds until after David's reign? The house of the Lord at Shiloh that will be set up is a temporary place. There's a lot of time that takes place here in God getting His people refined. And it's always through conflict. Always. It's never without conflict. You got enemies of God dying, and you've got people of God dying who aren't doing things right, putting their hand up and trying to save the ark when it's stumbling. God said, don't do that. There's a way to handle that thing. And so it never ceases to amaze me, even today in our own lives as Christians, why we have maybe not done as good of a job as teaching and preaching people that we, through conflict, will arise as victors and champions, which is heaven. We, through conflict. God's working on us every day if we're faithful. So again, back to the book of Joshua. You have this right here at the brink of Jordan, and they're getting ready to march over. Rahab tells them that we've heard. That's faith, by the way. Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. We've heard about these things. In chapter 3, they come to Jordan. Look at verse 1. They cometh to the Jordan. The Lord again encourages them. Verse 1 says, Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. So let me try to see if I've got a map up here. I don't know if that map is what I'm wanting or looking for. That just kind of puts in perspective the Jordan River in comparison to a modern-day image. That was a couple of weeks ago when I put that one together. There's a picture of the modern-day Jordan River Valley. Maybe a little bit more context and perspective. You can still see the farming going on around some of the banks there. It's a very rolling-hilled country. I've had a lot of people that have told me when they've gone over there that it really reminded them of the hill country of Texas, the way it looks and the way it feels, you know, the rolling hills. And that's the country that they were living in, that they would move to, the promised land. And so here again, they come to the Jordan, he and all the children of Israel lodged there before they passed over. It came to pass after 3 days, verse 2, that the officers went through the host, And they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the priest, the Levites bearing it, then ye shall remove from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Come not near unto it, that ye may know the way by which ye must go, for ye have not passed this way heretofore. This is new ground. You're fixing to break new ground. Joshua said unto the people, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spake unto the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass over before the people. And they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And here's God's encouragement, verse 7 and following. The Lord said unto Joshua, this day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. And thou shalt command the priests that bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when ye are come to the brink of the water of Jordan, ye shall stand still in Jordan. That's an interesting context to me. You're going to stand still in this water for a time. You're breaking a threshold here. And I want you just to stay with me here. Joshua said, hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanite, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth passeth over before you into Jordan. Now therefore, take 12 men out of the tribes of Israel, out of every tribe of man, and it shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, notice the reference, the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand upon a heap. And it came to pass, when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as they that bear the Ark were come unto Jordan, the feet of the priests that bear the Ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of harvest, and the waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon a heap very far from the city Adam, that is beside Zaratan. And those that came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, fell and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bare the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan. And all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. Would it have been an interesting consideration to see that, the dry ground again? They'd already seen this in a major sense in it coming across the Red Sea. By this time, you would think that this would be constant evidence and reminders that God is with you. God is with you. And He hasn't failed you. He won't fail you. Your own failures have failed you. Your own impatience has failed you, but God's never failed you. And this screen here will kind of maybe give you a little perspective. I thought this was interesting because of certain, again, geographical and geological considerations people, scientists, like to point out. You got this African, where's my pointer? You got this African Teutonic plate here that they say is kind of right through here along this valley, and they call this over here the Arabian Teutonic Plates. Well, I'm no Teutonic Plate expert, and so I don't even go there with you, but I know that there is some plate movement. There are fault lines and various things that shift and move in the earth, and thus causing great rumbling earthquakes. But just kind of interesting, there are some considerable geographical, geological information in this area. Possible route of the Jews coming through here at the north of the Dead Sea. And right over here is the old El Tel Jericho. Of course, this is the ancient location. That's the current city's over here, kind of all surrounding it. But I wanted you to know something, notice something on this screenshot here. The walls of Jericho. Notice how it's kind of built up on a hill. Very common for cities to be built upon hills. Why did they do that? Protection, yeah. Fortification. You got the high ground, you've got security. But at the side of Jericho, you have this outer wall here. Then you have an inner wall. And that's not uncommon as well. The city of Jerusalem will have several walls around it. But it's this wall right here that we, I think, read about that actually just is destroyed and comes in and folds inward. And archaeology and so forth has found great evidence of fire and various things. But the wall here is leaning inward. Now, again, where they actually breached the wall, we'll talk about that, but the actual pinpointing of that in reality is maybe not as easy. But there is a lot of archaeological evidence on this site location. Now, I'm going to fast forward here to these contexts because I want to talk about something a little bit more broader and then narrow it back in to Jericho if we can. I want to go back to Numbers 32 for a moment and again notice some of the language that is preparing them for the promised land. Numbers chapter 32. Remember the account of the Reubenites and the Gadites. And before they cross over the Jordan, you remember the story in Numbers 32 where the children of Reuben and Gad, they had a great multitude of cattle, and when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that behold, the place was a place for cattle, was a good place for cattle. And they want that land. And so in Numbers 32 and in chapters 34 through 35, you have disclosure of locations before the land. And Israelites, these two tribes in particular, desiring the land on this side of the river. And look at Numbers 32, where they're challenged by God. Look at the end of, look at verse 14 and 15. Well, verse 13 says, the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until all the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was consumed. And behold, you are risen up in your father's stead in an increase of sinful men to augment yet the fierce anger of the Lord toward Israel. For if you turn away from after him, he will yet again leave them in the wilderness, and ye shall destroy all this people. Now, they came near unto him and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our cattle and cities and so forth. In verse 20 through 23, Moses said unto them, if you will do this thing, if you will go armed before the Lord to war, you're going to have to go in. You're going to have to go fight with your brethren. And we'll go all of you armed over Jordan before the Lord until that he hath driven out his enemies from before him, the land he subdued before them, and so forth. Verse 23, but if you will not do so, behold, ye have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Now, this is a study. I would encourage you, study the tribe of Gad and the Reubenites. Study this tribe and find out in history which of the tribes are first consumed when it comes to much of the captivities that will take place, especially due to the divided kingdom during the days of Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Look at in history and geographically speaking, which tribes are first taken in by the Assyrians. And you study it out and you consider whether there's a consequence to their choice here. I believe there is. I believe there's a consequence for this perhaps, what do you call it? My mom used to tell me all the time, delay your gratification. I believe there's a consequence to here. And these two tribes will go into Assyrian captivity early, because of the location here is not as prime. Again, that's just a kind of a side note that will point you back towards the future and consider again the ramification and consequences of this choice. But just think about that, the Reubenites and the Gadites. But then look at Numbers chapter 34 through 35, where again the borders of the land are mentioned even here, the land that Moses will get to see for himself, the names of the men which will divide the land in chapter 34, the lands before them. Look at verse 16, Numbers 34, verse 16. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, these are the names of the men which shall divide the land unto you, Eleazar, the priest, and so forth, Joshua, the son of Nun. And ye shall take one prince of every tribe to divide the land by inheritance, and the names of the men, and so forth and so on. Chapter 35. The 8 and 40 cities that are given to the Levites. Remember the Levites, were they given an inheritance? Who was the inheritance of the Levites? The cities. But there's a passage, I didn't write it down, that where the Lord says, I am the Levites' inheritance. They're in my service. And you might think that's interesting. I do. You know, the Levites, the priests. Who are the priests today in the New Testament? Christians. Who is our inheritance? God is. I mean, ultimately, in the big picture, maybe. All right, so you think about that. So Numbers 35 then gives you some of the layout of the land and the cities before even taking the land. And so I find it interesting in verse 9, some of the laws pertain to murder and to those refuge cities, cities of refuge. And you can go back and see they had a justice system that was quite just. Our justice system, do you have any idea? The original founders and people based a lot of the judgments, the moral and ethical judgments, based upon what book? What law? This law right here, the law of Moses. Yes, right. Because it was a just law. Why were there sodomy laws in the books in all states? Because it was a just law. It protects against disease. It protects against immorality, a decay on society. You know, people don't like to talk about that in secular politics because they want to try to separate morality from laws. But laws are based in morality. Why is man not to pursue his enemy and slay him just because he hates his guts? There's a moral clause behind those laws. Can you make laws without moral clauses? If we were not a people without the need for order, then what kind of a people would we be? You'd have to be some pre-programmed robot, and then that pre-program would be your law or your code of ethics. And then I suppose the great programmer of all that would have to program all the computers to get along and work together in perfect harmony until the oil or whatever, the lubrication started to fail. The battery started to... the atheist mindset and the secular mindset is just horrible. It's a reprobate mind, truly reprobate. Anyway... All right, back to Deuteronomy chapter 2, just for a moment. Deuteronomy chapter 2. And again, here, notice here how God was in sense. Remember the descendants of Abraham, the related ones, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites. I want you to notice here the Lord speaking to Moses, to the people, the children of Israel. Look at verse 4. And command thou the people, saying, ye are to pass through the coast of your brethren, the children of Esau, which dwell in Seir, and they shall be afraid of you. Take ye good heed unto yourselves, therefore. Meddle not with them, for I will not give you their land. No, not so much as a foot breadth. Because I have given Mount Seir unto Esau for a possession. Now, they're going to have some problems here because they're not going to allow them to go through very easily. And guess what? They're going to get in trouble, the Edomites. We might as well take the time and enjoy the study. Look at the book of Obadiah just for a moment. Go to the minor prophet, Obadiah. And let's look at what the... We referred to this. After Amos, before Jonah. And notice here, the study of the Edomites. they had refused passage through the land to Israel back in Numbers 20 and 21. There were some things that God wasn't going to forget. And look at verse 10 of chapter, well, the only chapter, chapter 1. Obadiah, verse 10. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day of that strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them, allied. You see, these Edomites, descendants of Esau, would get further and further away from God. Further and further away from Abraham and his promise. And they were privy to that promise. And they were not favorable to it. And as they get further and further away, God doesn't forget. Look at verse 14. Neither shouldest thou have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. Neither shouldest thou have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. What's the word heathen mean? Then. It was Gentile. It was nations other than God's people. And Obadiah, though related and kindred, and God set aside this land and said, you can have that land for a possession, and I will not give that to Israel. You have done wickedly as the heathen, as thou hast done. Verse 15. It shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. And so God would deal with the Edomites in time, the Ammonites and the Moabites. But notice here again, back in Deuteronomy chapter 2, the study here, the Moabites and also the Ammonites. Who were the descendants of whom? Who were the Moabites and the Ammonites descendants of? That's right. All right, look at verse verse 9. And the Lord said unto me, distress not the Moabites, neither contend with them in battle, for I will not give thee of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar unto the children of Lot for a possession. And then look at verse 19. And when thou comest nigh over against the children of Ammon, distress them not, nor meddle with them. For I will not give thee of the land of the children of Ammon any possession, because I have given it unto the children of Lot for a possession. And so, verse 24, he says, there rise up, take your journey, and pass over the river Arnon, behold, and so forth, and then they'll start to move forward. And that doesn't, that, this is not to say that the Ammonites, the Moabites, and again, the Edomites are friendly with the Israelites. There's a mutual responsibility. Balaam gets involved with this, and you remember Balaam's destroyed here in later on. Forget the chapter where that's at. But remember some of that. Remember some of that history as we consider the lands over here. Any comments or questions before I move back now to Joshua 13 through 24? Kind of a lot of information. I feel like I'm stuffing us. I hate to overstuff, don't you? Except for Thanksgiving and Christmas. All right, let's look at something here just to kind of lay out the land that will be divided for an inheritance. I'm not going to go into great detail with all the victories. I mean, the principles here have been laid out. And at Jericho, they have a great victory, right? But they turn right around in Joshua chapter 7, and what happens at Ai? Somebody takes of the spoil. Joshua rents his clothes, doesn't understand what's going on. Why can't we take this little city of Ai? And he finds out that there's some greedy people, covetous people is the word I'm looking for, covetousness, which is idolatry, amongst them. And we could talk about that a long time. But anyway, I want you to notice here, if you can see that map, this will be kind of the layout. Notice right there, Reuben and Gad. Manasseh will go up here, and they'll get this upper part right up through here. Judah will be down here. And by the way, north and south, when we get to the divided kingdom, which one is the southern and which one is the northern? Southern down here, Judah, and they remain faithful. There's Jerusalem. They'll remain faithful to the temple. And what is the northern kingdom called through Scripture? It's called Israel, and it's also called Ephraim. It's funny, you know, the language that's associated with people. Sometimes the nation of Israel is called what? I think it's called metonymy. I think the big word. No, they're called Jacob, just like we read over there in Obadiah. He'll sometimes refer to Israel as Jacob, and he's talking about the whole nation, your brother Jacob. When he's talking to the nations, and he's referring back to the familial lineages and so forth, and the relationship. You know, when you're a young kid and you don't catch all that, or you're studying the Bible and you see all these names, you don't maybe step back and realize that's a word being referred to talking about an entire nation of people. And so, just some things that we probably know, but just to kind of remind us. So, anyway, this becomes the land that's divided for an inheritance. You can see a lot of the cities and stuff that are listed and labeled on this map, and that's why I kind of posted this. If you go back and you were to look at some of those Levitical cities and so forth, you'll see some of the names. You also have to keep in mind that a lot of these cities and locations and names are still speculative to today. We're not sure. We find what's called tales. You know what a tale is? You ever heard of the statement telltale sign? You know what that means? Well, no. In archaeology, a tell is a mound where an old city was. And as they dig into that mound, what do they find? Telltale signs. So that's the idiom. So this again, a lot of these locations are nothing but tells. They're mounds of dirt and artifacts and potsherds and old walls that have fallen in. And what happens when man builds things and things fall down and they're not swept clear and clean with excavators and dozers like we have today? It just mounds up. And over time, the dirt and the dust will overtake it. So again, a lot of these locations are tells, and they're still trying to figure out, like by identification, which tell, which city this might be. And it's a great archaeological challenge because they get to go in there and look for markers, a piece of pottery, potsherd, or a manuscript or something that's inscribed in Hebrew letters, and they locate cities by that sometimes. And they can also determine things based upon the stylistic Hebrew writing. For example, do y'all remember learning cursive when you were in school? Now, I haven't checked with the school here, but did you know back in Arkansas where we came from, cursive is not y'all, do you still learn cursive in college? They don't teach it anymore, do they? Third grade? They don't know it. They don't teach it. Boy, I had to learn it, and I got in trouble for not learning it. But here's my point. Historically speaking, do you see archaeology being able to go back and find writing, English, and say, oh, that was cursive, and that was taught throughout these times. We know this, but sometime around 2000, whenever, they quit and it started to phase out, and they will date. They will date if 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years stands. They'll date and put timelines together like that. Same thing with the Hebrew writing. The letters in the stylistic writing of Hebrew, though the writing and the letters didn't change, the actual slants and various things might have. So they can put dates together and times. And again, by people that are far more experienced and educated than I am. I just like to read. So, okay, so that's kind of that. I'm trying to see where I'm at there. Again, there's that kind of layout of the cities. Notice here again, there were natural ramparts that would go into the city. It's this wall right here that I believe archaeology with these old ancient ramparts have discovered that show clearly these walls having folded inward. And I don't remember if I actually tried to get you a picture or not. Yeah, there's a site location, a digging of the ancient Tel Jericho. What does that tell you? It tells you nothing. It tells me nothing. I see a bunch of rocks that were, I guess, a long time ago piled up. And that's what I find whenever I'm looking around searching for images. That was the best one I thought. But nonetheless, we're going to kind of wrap it up here. We're out of time. I appreciate your attention, and we'll finish up. We'll get through this, Lord willing.